Corbin Middlemass here. The Ashes were awesome, but they are over. The good news is the cricket keeps rolling as the focus shifts to the T20 World Cup. Australia is trying to climb back to the top, India is looking all powerful, and England is trying to turn Ashes shame into T20 glory. And did we mention the backroom power struggles? The ABC Cricket Podcast is dropping every Monday and Friday as former opener Ed Cowan joins me to pull apart the juiciest storylines in the game. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When I was about 11 or 12 years old, I used to have sleepovers at a friend's house. And at night, we sometimes used to put our shoes on and sneak out of the house at around 3 a.m. And then we go wandering around the sleeping suburb. It was great because nothing looked the same. It was like the suburb had been pulled inside out. And this wasn't to prank anyone. It was just so we could enjoy how strange and magical the streets looked while everything was dark and everyone was asleep. Except not everyone was asleep. Dan Richards is here again on Conversations to talk about those people who live in the night. Dan is a writer and broadcaster based in Scotland who feels the mystery and terror of the night in his bones. Over the past few years, Dan has travelled out to meet people who commandeer the overnight ferry running from Aberdeen to the Shetland Islands, sometimes through gale force winds. He's been out to meet charity workers who comb the streets of London, looking for rough sleepers. He's met helicopter search and rescue teams who go out in search of people who might be freezing to death. He's met nurses on the night shift and exhausted mums sitting up at 4 a.m. trying to get their baby to sleep. Dan's book is called Overnight: Journeys, Conversations, and Stories After Dark. Welcome back, Dan.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me back on.
Your book begins with this wonderful story, which was the thing that got you thinking about the world at night. It begins with you stranded on the side of a Swiss mountain. Tell me how that happened, Dan.
It happened because of fundamental misunderstanding of the risks and needs of of going up an Alp, really. If you're going to go up an Alp, there's a top tip for people, a couple of top tips. Be quite fit, take some food, don't take my father, I would say. Those are the top three. It was for a different book. We were last talking about a book I wrote called Outpost, which was about things on the edge. And before that, I wrote a book that went in the footsteps and handholds of my great-great-aunt, Dorothy Pilley. And she was a pioneering mountaineer in the 20th century. And as part of that book, I thought, well, I don't want to be vicarious. I don't want to do all this from archives, because that book would then be a dimension short. So in my great wisdom, I decided to follow her up some of her very severe mountains and up these very severe routes. And of course, realised quite early on that she was a really, really very proficient and fit mountaineer. And I was not. But weirdly, that did not put me off. And in fact, I decided to get my father involved, which, you know, no logic involved to any of this, really. And we ended up on the side of a mountain called the Dent Blanche in Switzerland, which is a beautiful mountain viewed from the bottom.
The White Tooth.
The White Tooth, yeah, it'll eat you all up, it turns out, if you you go up it and then don't come off it in time. And there's a lovely word, benighted, which means to be overtaken by darkness. But in our case, it also meant stuck. So we sat down on this mountain, having laboriously gone up it, and then turns out laboriously coming down takes time as well. And we stopped because of weather, and it was the right thing to do to stop. And we had a grandstand view of the Matterhorn, and down in Zermatt, down below, you could see lights moving. And we were overtaken by darkness and also snow and also fatigue. And in my father's case, overtaken by the horrid realization that he was 60 years old rather than 30. And my horrid realization that my father wasn't quite, you know, across this, shall we say. He wasn't all over this.
So what are you doing here? Were you huddling on a ledge? Is that what you were doing or what?
We roped ourselves onto a ledge and sat out the night and waited for the light to return. And we had a long night of talking to each other, which was great to a point. And then I was looking out at the sky, and when it wasn't snowing across us, there was the moon, and it was beautiful. The ISS space station was going over. You had the planes going over. You had the amazing stars. You could see the Milky Way. It was astonishing. And I began thinking about everybody who was awake and life continuing. You know, it's that T.S. Eliot line about the still point in the moving world. We were very much that. And quite high in my thoughts was the idea that a search and rescue team might, you know, someone might have tried to be helpful and phoned one. And in Switzerland, that would mean that we had to, well, my dad would definitely have to remortgage his house and various things, because a cup of coffee is about 10 quid. So, you know, I imagine a search and rescue helicopter would be more than that. So listening to the sounds, hoping against hope that no helicopters were coming. And, you know, it begins to percolate this idea of the night as a place not of universal rest, not of universal calm. The fact that there are people working, the people who are working around the clock to keep people safe, the people who are out when other people are indoors. And, you know, night is universal only in the sense that everyone goes through it. But everyone's night, I began to think, is very individual, because night is a time when you're thrown back against yourself. Anyone who's been unhappily awake during the small hours knows that they are not small. And we all have these brains who think, well, yeah, I could let you sleep, or I could remind you of that time that really embarrassing thing happened. And that's what I'm discussing with you on the radio today, Richard, all my embarrassing things in Switzerland.
It turns out you have family members who've spent time in the night shift, and there was your mum who worked nights as a night nurse on the wards. Tell me the story she told you about a strange encounter she had one night with a patient.
When I was very young, my mum was a nurse in Wales, in Swansea. And she would have been very young. She would have been in her late teens, early 20s. But she was on the night shift. She was overseeing a ward of sleeping patients. And she was doing the check. And you didn't want to wake people, because it's important. You know, sleep and night can be very healing to people. It's a very calm time sometimes. And she was going around with her torch. And she came to one patient, and there was a black shape on his face. And this was the eye hospital, so people had had potentially surgery or things like that. So he had a bandaged face. And her immediate thought, you see a black shape, you think, oh, maybe someone needs help, maybe they're bleeding or something like that. But it became immediately apparent that this black shape was actually a little bat that had got into the ward. This was probably a little pipistrelle bat, so about the size of your hand or smaller. And it was inquisitively picking at the bandages. And we don't have, you know, any blood-sucking bats. In fact, there are none in Europe. Bats have had a very bad time. I blame Bram Stoker for a lot of it. And, you know, but a little perfectly, probably benign bat on this man's face. And my mother was faced with a choice. Do you turn the lights on? Do you raise the alarm? Do you wake up, some people? It's nightmarish, the scene. You know, all of these people with bandaged faces. Do you turn the lights on and shout, bat? No, you don't. But also, she didn't really want to let senior nurses know, because this was an opportunity for her just to sort the situation out. So she went to the linen cupboard. She got a towel and she wrapped the bat up and she flapped it out the window, and everyone slept on and everything was fine. In the night, that sort of story, that sort of encounter, it's closer. There are things in the night that occasionally crop up, that we have these meetings. And there's a lovely line in a Robert Frost poem, Acquainted with the Night, where he encounters a clock, the bright face of this clock, and it says that the time is neither wrong nor right. And I think there is an uncanniness about the night. And it is a thing where there are magical wonders that lurk. There's frightening things, but there's also amazing things in the night. It is a place of encounters, and everybody is at a slight disadvantage and advantage in the night, if you know what I mean. And the night is a time to see maybe known things with fresh eyes, or encounter things only ever dreamt of.
One of the most terrifying nights of my childhood was lying in bed one night, and there was a possum outside in the tree, and I had no idea what noise the noise that possums make at night when they're, I don't know, feeling like they want to get it on with another possum. But they tend to make this awful noise. They make this, I don't know if it's the same in the UK, but they make this.
Oh, wow.
And if you're a little boy lying in bed, that just sounds, I don't know, like some awful demon from hell. It was perfectly
monstrous.
And it was doing it all night. So I lay there not daring to move in my bed in a state of perfect terror. Do you remember having nights like that as a boy?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember being very interested in every night at about midnight, hearing the people coming home from the pub. And they always seemed quite jolly. And I remember thinking, well, that's something to aim for, isn't it? You know, I'll come home singing a song. And also, we were underneath the flight path of the planes coming into Bristol Airport. This was in southwest England. So they'd be coming in from Scotland or all over Europe. And our house was the point where the engines changed note. So you'd hear them coming in, and then they would change very subtly, and then they'd begin their descent. And likewise, I could hear the trains that were going from Bristol to London, and you'd get these express trains which seemed to kind of grow out of the night and then roar past and then dwindle away. And I think there's a poetry to this, but also it's a way of building memories.
Speaking of your mother's experience, 15 years or so ago, I spent a couple of weeks in hospital, and the hospital wards at night were really quite strange and peaceful. I was on heavy painkillers, so it was a strangely delirious time. But you've had your own experience with that in recent years. Tell me, when you contracted COVID, how ill were you when you were actually brought in by ambulance into your local hospital?
I wasn't well. I mean, we'd been very careful because we didn't want to give COVID to other people if we caught it. But as it turned out, we were the ones who needed to worry when we caught it, my partner and I. And she rallied, I suppose, about a week and a half in, and I really did not. My blood oxygen went through the floor. Three paramedic in hazmat suits turned up and took me away, and I was sped to hospital in an ambulance. I was rushed in. I was not in a good way. And I think of it really as being medically sectioned, you know. Everyone was very kind, but there was no question of me leaving.
Dan, did you know you were dying at the moment? Did you understand that, or did the doctors actually have to tell you that you were in danger of dying?
I think their actions, even in that state, spoke to me that I was in danger. Someone told me I was dying later, and they'd caught me in time. They took a lot of blood, they did a lot of tests, they put drips in and things like that. Weirdly, I was still in that state where I felt that I had some agency and I could bargain with them, but there was none of that. I described the hospital in that moment as a place of great care but no comfort, because there wasn't time. And when eventually I was put on a ward, I was on one-to-one care for a while, a doctor came and had a chat with me, and he was from the critical care unit, and he said that they were minded to intubate because my blood oxygen, they were giving me as much oxygen as they could, but my blood oxygen was still, in retrospect, terrifyingly low. And then someone went away and phoned my mother, and they gave her all the details, and they said that she should sleep with her phone in her hand, because if they did intubate, which involves putting the patient in an induced coma so that you can put oxygen directly into the lungs, essentially you put tubes into me, for my own good, obviously, it was all for my own good, but to sleep with your phone in your hand, and she was 400 miles away, and I had a conversation with the doctor about dying alone, definitely, I remember that, because Anna, my partner, was only about 5 miles away, but she couldn't have come in, my parents were a long way away, and you begin to think about all of the people that you'll miss, and all of the conversations that you wish you'd had. I mean, all I was told to breathe deeply, and I kept waking up, and I was so angry because I had one job, you know? And isn't it strange that I had all these thoughts of people I'd like to talk to and messages I'd like to send, but I did nothing at all. I lay there feeling profoundly confused and sad. And in the morning, I was still there, and my blood oxygen ticked up a bit. But strangely, in the night also, I had a voice come to me twice. And it was only in retrospect I realised that I think the voice was the writer and playwright Alan Bennett, the Northern writer and playwright Alan Bennett, came to me in the night. And it's the most... I think if we had the choice of guardian angel, we'd choose someone like, you know, Judy Dench or something, wouldn't we? Dame Judy Dench, something like that. Alan Rickman, someone with gravitas. And I'm not saying Alan Bennett doesn't have gravitas, but there are a couple of things here. He's not dead. So I don't know what business he has coming to people in the night. When they're, you know.
And what did guardian angel Alan Bennett say to you?
Well, he was very passive-aggressive. And this voice just came to me and said, I'm surprised you're not taking more of an interest.
See, what does it mean?
I don't know, but I found it profoundly unhelpful and passive aggressive. And I think the second time it happened, I said, sod off, Alan, or words to that effect. And it's funny because I think that the origin of this was that would be the fact that when I was a child, I had audiobooks and Alan Bennett read things like, you know, The Wind in the Willows and the Winnie the Pooh books and Alice in Wonderland, things like that. So maybe his voice is now hardwired into my head as a safe space of stories that end well. So he was coming to me, but it was a strange thing. And the irony of all of this is that writing the overnight book, I thought for ages, oh, it would be great to get into a hospital. It would be great to observe the night shift. And then the pandemic happened and I thought, well, we'll put that one on ice because it seems a bit unreasonable to ask people for their time. I thought, well, I'm not going to bother people in the NHS at this key, you know, moment of strain. But if you turn up in an ambulance with a blood oxygen of 83, they'll let you stay for about a week, which as a writer, if you survive to write it down, you've done your job, I think.
What kind of things are you hearing, lying in bed, or sensing about you when you're going through that long, dark night where you're angry with yourself because you keep falling asleep when it's your job to stay awake, to keep breathing and keep breathing deeply? How aware were you of what was going on around you in the ward that awful night?
Well, I think it's a strange one because you're hearing the machines around you. You're hearing your internal monologue, I guess. But also, time ceases to flow in a normal way. I think of my hospital stay as quite twilight. And actually, I went back and had a bit of a debrief with the consultant who was looking after me and the charge nurse, the ward sister, who, with her team of nurses, was keeping me alive. And I said to them, you know, were the curtains drawn around my bed the whole time? Because I don't remember daylight. And they said, no. Day and night were happening around you like they were for everyone. But I think as with being told to breathe deeply and waking up because you've gone to sleep, I think my body was taking charge, you know. As you can tell, I have a busy brain. I like to chat. I like to think and go over things. And I don't know that's always helpful when you need core function to get you out of a hole. And I think my body just put my brain to sleep, you know. Put your brain to sleep. Tune it all out, just rest, and try and breathe, breathe, breathe. I think that's what happens. Everything was ambient. There was kind of ambient fury. There was ambient noise of the machines that were helping me stay alive. And I think that's kind of true of the night in general.
So as you recovered, you went out into the world to meet people who work on night shifts, and you went on that overnight ferry in Scotland, that travels between Aberdeen and the north of Scotland, and then onto the Orkneys and Shetland Islands. You went there in summer and in winter. How different did those two voyages in summer and winter look to you and feel to you?
Well, the winter one happened kind of perpendicular to the summer one because we were in a force 9 gale veering cyclonic, which is the sort of thing that you hear on the shipping forecast over here with the BBC, but it's quite another thing to be on a ship when that's happening to you, you know?
I'm astonished the ferry went out in that weather in the first place.
It was about on the line of where they would sail. I mean, it was interesting because I had some access to the bridge and the crew, and you're on the bridge with these incredibly hardy sailors, and they have sea legs, which means that they can stand securely and they don't run into the walls and become instantaneously violently sick, which is how you can tell a civilian on a ship like that. They just stood there and they were sailing. But even then, when they turned the big lights on to face ahead and you saw these waves gianting towards you, you know, and they were 8 meter high waves and hanging there, and crazed and marbled, black and white. Even the captain, the master of the ship, said, okay, I think we've had enough of that. We don't have to see what we're going into.
And well, Dan, is that worse? What is worse? Is it worse pitching around without seeing those giant marbled waves you're talking about, or is it worse when you can't see them?
It's going to happen anyway, I think, was the general view. And the way that the whole ship was ringing like Thor's hammer was whacking into the front, into the bow. If you imagine that the ship was going down a motorway and demolishing those overbridges, the concrete overbridges, every 100 yards, that's how it sounded. We weren't going straight into the storm. The navigator plotted this course that would be a slight sort of, I suppose, 45 degrees to the oncoming waves, but even so. And, you know, there were lots of other ships out that night, and we were a roll-on, roll-off ferry, and we had stabilizer fins, so even though the up and down was quite pronounced, the roll side to side was not as bad as it could have been. But there were other ships servicing oil rigs and fishing vessels out on the North Sea that night without stabilizer fins, and your mind and your heart goes out to these people who are being beset by the ultimate in elemental forces, you know. And at one point, a search and rescue helicopter flew down the side of us on its way to Aberdeen. And I think in that moment, we were all very much aware that somebody potentially was in a far worse state than we were.
Dan, being in that situation when you can't see out the window, it's perfectly dark at night in these gale force winds and these incredibly dangerous seas, pitching about without your inner ear being able to stabilise. I know you've not been to space, but I wonder if that's what it must feel like, being pitched around in an aircraft where you really are not at all certain which way is up and which way is down.
I think potentially. I mean, the things that you have that are in common with being in a ship out in space or on the North Sea is the fact that you feel very small. You feel very helpless. And I think night is sometimes a time when the sense that we are in charge breaks down. It's a time of vulnerability. It's a time where you wake up in the morning with the news cycle, and sometimes things have happened in the night. Probably shouldn't mention this, with the ashes, because I'd go to sleep with the ashes and things would be going relatively well. And this has happened also to me with a number of elections in the States and things like that, where things seem relatively fine and I go to sleep and I wake up in the morning and I think it's my fault, of course, for going to sleep, isn't it? I've taken my eye off the ball here. Maybe if I just stayed awake, I could have willed a slightly different outcome. You know, Ben Stokes seemed in perfect control when I went to sleep, but he's had some sort of like catastrophic psychic break during the night, and here we all are.
To that end, the Australian cricket team is going to organise for you to be drugged or something to put you to sleep, because that's how we ensure victory, is you going to bed, Dan.
Well, it turns out, yes, I am the kryptonite of England and Wales cricket board. And I think there is that sense, though, of being out of control. I mean, it's something that we strive to avoid in life, but you can't be in control when you're asleep. And one of the things that happened after getting out of hospital is that I had night terrors because of the things that had happened to me. And the book is full of people and situations who are going into the night when other people are at rest in order to help, or in order to, in some way, alleviate people whose nights are not calm, people whose nights are not in control. You know, be that search and rescue helicopters, be that people who go out on the streets of London to try and offer some comfort and alleviate the suffering of rough sleepers. At the heart of the project for me was this idea of service. Service is an interesting word and not terribly fashionable, but it's one of the great things I think that you can do as a person, is to give of your time, to give of your life in the service and care of somebody else. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you work in a hospital. It could be that you work in the postal service. It could be that you're up very early and giving of your night to bake bread for people, that you're nursing young children. This amazing time when young parents, often young mothers, are awake during the night nursing to infants, often incredibly young. I mean, everyone starts, I believe this is the way it works, with very young infants. You don't really start age 3. I've learned recently, children do not know how to sleep. They don't really know how to behave when they emerge, and you are there in the night in this amazing state of love and, how to put this, crazed, trying to negotiate. And that's something that's happened to me recently. And it gives me a renewed respect for people sort of going through the night. And yet, it's not necessarily discussed. It's something that people, I think, at a biological level, try and forget how harrowing it can be.
Yes, you have become a father in recent weeks, is that right?
Yes, we had our first child on January the 15th. So at the moment, I'm 3 and a bit weeks in. It's been a long year already, and we are just in February. So, you know, I'm enjoying it. He's a delightful chap when he's asleep or when he's happy. But when that is, you know, only he is the judge. We're doing our best to facilitate a nice time for him. But he doesn't really know what he wants.
No, but now you know what that long night is like with the baby, where the baby won't go to sleep, doesn't want to go to sleep, or can't go to sleep, and you have to deal with that profound exhaustion that, if you're lucky, is sustained by overwhelming love. It's a strange experience.
It is. It's one of these things that nothing can prepare you for. Every experience of parenthood is different. I mean, there are broadly similar themes, but you either get a child who will sleep or they won't. And even if they do at this stage, they may then change their mind. You know, I'm the sort of chap who goes to the Arctic and meets polar bears. And yet I would say that parenthood is as fascinating, is as eye-opening, is as wonderful. It gives you that overview effect as doing these things, which I think, you know, we tell ourselves a real adventure is going into space, a real adventure is going out in a force 9 gale, things like that. But actually, no, the things that define us often, I think, are acts of care, they're acts of love, they're how you are when you're at your limits. And it's interesting to me that people don't talk about motherhood, fatherhood, young parenthood in those terms. And I have so much respect for people who care. I think caring professions are not celebrated enough. It was notable that during the pandemic in the UK, there was a drive by Boris Johnson's government to clap for medical people, clap for nurses, clap for doctors. Whereas I would say that paying them a decent whack would actually show more empathy and alleviation in that way. It's all very well us saying, we appreciate what you do, but you try doing it, mate. And I think parenthood is one of those things where you really come up at the sharp end of it. And it gave me a sort of renewed respect and empathy and hopefully kind of patience and love. I hope I feel galvanized by it. At the same time, absolutely knackered, Richard. Absolutely knackered.
You mentioned service before there, Dan, and that seems to be a common thread in the stories of the people you met who are up at night working in the secret world of night. Service seems to be the thing that binds the workers in those places together and gives them a sense of what they do is worthwhile and needed, and that's the thing that carries them through the night.
I think that's right. I think there's a shared humanity to it. You know, the bakers who bake the bread are not going to sit and watch you eat it. You know, they're just sending it into the world, and there is this sense of a job well done. My grandfather worked in the Royal Mail on the mail trains for quite a lot of the 20th century. After he came back from World War II, he was on the Bristol to Plymouth TPO, travelling post office train, and he did that job until the 70s. And that involved getting up early and going to Bristol Temple Meads station and getting on his mail coach with a lot of mail that was then sorted and amazingly dropped off and also picked up en route. They had these apparatus at the side of the line, so the steam train would be going through with an express and my grandfather's coach would be next to the loco at the front for various reasons. I mean, he would say so he could get tea from the engine at various points, you know, get some hot water. But also with the bags that you would hang out the side of the coach and pick up at the side of the coach in nets, you really didn't want any passengers sticking their head out of the window at an inopportune time, because then there's a lot of paperwork to fill out. So he would be going down and mail would be bouncing into the coach and being dropped off at speed, and people would be sorting. And all of this is the work that was hymned in the Night Mail film with a verse commentary by W.H. Auden and music by Benjamin Britten in the 30s. So he was doing that, and he would always talk of his time on the railways and in the Royal Mail with a great sense of pride, because it was a national service that people could send a letter down in Cornwall, and as part of a network of these trains, it would be delivered to Edinburgh the next morning. You know, you put a first-class stamp on it and it would arrive. And these stories that he would tell me of the mail getting through, even if the weather was awful or there were accidents and things like that, the mail always got through. And in the same way, whatever happens, this sense of a vital service, of people being not just a cog in a machine, but people being proud to serve. A lot of the people on his train, in fact, all of them would have been through the Second World War. You had this sense of community, this sense of responsibility, and this great sense of pride. My mother, likewise, in the NHS. And a lot of the people I spoke to, you know, the search and rescue helicopter team, many of whom are ex-RAF, going out in a helicopter to they don't know what. They would get a call, a briefing call. They'd be in the air within a set number of minutes. And one of the crew that I was talking to, I went to the Rescue 912, which is based in Humberside. He said, we would always go. We would always go. There's very few occasions. I think freezing fog is the time you wouldn't fly in a helicopter, or if there is so much mist or fog at the location that your forward-facing infrared cannot see, they're a rescue asset. If they can't rescue, there's no point in them being there. But he said, we would always go. And you have around the clock, around the UK, around the world, these teams of people who are on standby, be it in the emergency services, search and rescue, mountain rescue. The RNLI here, the lifeboats in the UK, it's astonishing to me that that is manned entirely by volunteers, people who have jobs during the day, and they have a pager next to their bed at night, and if that goes off, they get to the coastal station and they launch out to sea. But at the same time, the amount of people I've spoken to who don't see it as heroic, they see it as just what you do. You would go and you would try and help your fellow man. I think for people who aren't aware of that, for people who maybe don't know this is going on in their name, to discover what goes on round the clock, but particularly in the hours of darkness. Darkness is dangerous.
These people you're meeting are living in a kind of a secret world too, aren't they? Because it's at night, because they're often out at sea or in a port or in some other part of the world which is hidden from the waking world, no one really understands what it is that they do. And is that, I wonder if that's another thing that builds camaraderie between them, the fact that they operate in a kind of a hidden secret world from the rest of us?
I think that's right. There was the case, the ship, the container ship, the Ever Given, got stuck in the Suez Canal. And suddenly, everyone was aware of global shipping, global logistics. Everybody on the TV was suddenly an expert on global logistics. But it often takes something to go wrong for people to suddenly realise that these things exist. I mean, we're surrounded by things. If you look around, the majority of the things, where they are, will have come on a container ship, probably. Everything is connected, but it is a hidden world. We rely on it hugely. And so if you get a blockage like the Suez Canal, it's very much like the world of logistics is choking. But I think we are very good at ignoring things that just work. We are very good at taking things for granted. And it takes something like a pandemic. It takes something like a catastrophe to actually acknowledge that there are these worlds and systems and people who are helping the world go round. They're keeping us safe. They're keeping us replenished with things. And the world is often very close to going wrong. If these people don't turn up for work, we aren't very far away from being in trouble with this unless we keep things ticking over.
One of these classes of people who live in a kind of a secret world but are still operating in plain sight are people who sleep rough, homeless people. And so in London, you were with two overnight workers named Claire and Ella, who work for a charity called St. Mungo's. Tell me about your nights that you spent with them, what they do and the kinds of people you encountered with them.
I went out for a single night with these amazing ladies, and the things I saw were really, really distressing. And they and their colleagues are out every single night of the year and offering not just empathy and sympathy, but they are trying to alleviate the suffering, you know. And the charity is named after St. Mungo, who was, you know, that's famously what he did.
You were called out to attend to a couple who were sleeping rough in a side street off Edgware Road. What was going on there?
The couple were in a concrete garage, a concrete lot. They had a broken tent. They had some boxes. It was winter at the time. I think it was November when I was out with St. Mungo's. It's bitterly cold. and they needed help. The sprinkler system, for some reason, was operating, so they were wet, they were cold, they were frightened, they were exhausted. But something has gone wrong when you, and I say you choose to stay in this place, the choice has become so limited, I think, to move around. You don't want to get in trouble with the police because we have criminalized homelessness around the world. You know, we have criminalized people who are in need. That to see a homeless person, it's so easy to dehumanize that person and see them mainly as the embodiment of a problem. And yet it could be any of us. In the same way that global logistics, when it goes wrong, you notice fairly quickly, the world runs out of loo roll fairly quickly, unless these things are happening, and then suddenly it's a crisis. Many people are only a couple of paychecks away from not making rent. And if they don't have the support network of family, things like that, they can find themselves sofa surfing, and then you run out of patience with your friends, and then suddenly you find yourself just wandering the streets, and then suddenly you find yourself homeless. This is a story that repeats often. And then the night, in particular, is a dangerous time. You're surrounded by people who potentially have had a drink, people who are not the nicest people who are roaming the streets. You're surrounded by other homeless people. You get involved with drink or drugs to try and alleviate whatever's going on. And it spirals. One of the things that St. Mungo's in London are incredibly good at is trying to get people back to where they came from in the country, you know, because there is this feeling, this vibe, this myth that London will be the answer, the Dick Whittington thing, that the streets are paved with gold, or there is so much going on in London that someone will be able to help you. And there is an initiative called No Second Night, where people will try, if they see a newly homeless person, and there is a network of people who can be in touch with them, be they street sweepers or the police, an outreach worker will try and meet that person. They will try and ascertain their history, and they will try and get them back to where they come from in the country, because London is so full of people in need that sometimes going back to where you just left, you will have a better chance of finding help, of finding some sort of solace to work yourself out, because going to a big city, you think the answers lie there. And often you find yourself in more trouble than the thing that has driven you out.
When you go out to see people who've been sleeping rough, what kind of places are they attracted to? Where do they go in order to keep themselves safe or dry in order to pass the night?
Well, the irony is that they often go to places that are not conducive to sleep. They're not conducive to rest. They'll go to brightly lit places like railway stations. It depends as well. Men and women, your needs are different, because whilst men can walk the streets at night, it's a very dangerous and different proposition for a woman. Female rough sleepers will often try and hide during the night and be out during the day, whereas for men, it can be the other way around, because you're very vulnerable. You want to be somewhere where you are visible and safe, and at the same time, hidden from the world, because the world is frightening, and people are at the end of their tether. They've not necessarily slept. There's a reason that mental health among people on the streets is so poor, because if you take away sleep, you take away the brain's ability to reset. I remember when I was at university, I was visiting my parents, and I gave some money to a guy who needed to get into a shelter, and as a reflex, I said to him, "All right, mate, I hope that helps. Good night. Sleep well. Sweet dreams." And it's just a reflex. And he met my eye. And he said, "I don't dream anymore." It's never left me, that.
How did the COVID pandemic lead to some new approaches in dealing with homelessness in places like London?
Well, it's amazing a bit. I mean, to draw an analogy, you know, we couldn't have meetings at home until the pandemic, when suddenly everyone could get on, you know, Zoom and things like that and Teams, and suddenly it was possible because it was necessary. In the same way, it was possible to house all the homeless people in London. It was possible to do that because needs must, there's a pandemic on, you don't want the streets full of bodies. They could do it in the same way when we have a royal wedding. oh, isn't it amazing? You can house all these people on trains and whatever in London. You know, oh, great. It was possible the whole time. You just, you know, it's not where you felt your resources were best put, you know? So the pandemic was helpful to show what is possible. But as with so much post-pandemic, we've returned, you know, it's not the new normal, it's the old normal. People are very good at forgetting. And it shouldn't take a royal wedding, it shouldn't take a pandemic for these systems to be put in place, because people deserve second chances and respect, I think, because, as I say, it could be any one of us.
For the last couple of years, you and a friend have been leading night walks at a writers' festival in this little town called Wigtown in Scotland. What do you do on these walks?
That's really fun to do. Wigtown is a beautiful little town in a place called Dumfries and Galloway, which actually contains a dark sky zone. If you want to observe the stars, this is an amazing place to do it because there's a lack of light pollution there. And there's ancient forest, and you can go in and you can just see the sky as our ancestors would have a long time ago. You can see it undiminished by the lights of a city or a town. We take out groups of people and we give everyone red head torches, which allow their eyes to open up so they can really appreciate what's going on in the night sky. And I give them all headphones as well, so I can talk to them whilst we're walking, and I can play them poetry and music and readings. And we go out and we really just observe, and we open up our eyes and we open up our minds to what's going on. And I always do that with my friend Elizabeth, who's a dark sky ranger, which I just think is a great job title to have. She will shine her laser up in the sky and point out Andromeda. She'll point out these star systems and tell the stories that ancient civilizations projected onto these stars. And it's a lovely night. Often I'll play music to people, and I actually play a recording of the Night Mail, the Auden and Britain recording, and it's quite hypnotic. So you find this group of people as they walk along falling into step as they listen to "This is the Night Mail crossing the border, bringing the check and the postal order, letters for the rich, letters for the poor, diddle-a-da, diddle-a-da." And we're all in sync with each other. Afterwards, we might have a drink and everybody's full of enthusiasm and full of story, and they're going to go home and see the night and experience the night with new eyes. And it's a lovely thing. It's a privilege to do it.
You say you want people to feel the grace, something like the grace of the overnight. What is that feeling, that grace? Is it a kind of comfort or a freedom or something else?
I think the grace of the overnight is the fact that we exist in the world, and the world exists in the universe, and we have all of these cycles and systems operating around us. Not all the world goes to sleep when we go to sleep. And I think to be mindful of that, to open a window and listen, to look up at the sky, to just think about the people who are still awake and operating around us. The natural world is still going on around us. There are still cycles in the seasons that are happening. The ISS is still going over us. The world is actually full of life and movement and labor when we are choosing to sleep. And much of that actually is for our good, to help us. That to me is the grace of the overnight. It's happening whether you like it or not. And it's happening often. Things are happening that will directly benefit you.
Dan, every night on the BBC, at some point just after midnight, this music starts to play in. It's become quite famous. Dan, what is this music? It's really lovely, but what is it, and why has it become such a loved institution in the UK?
So that is Sailing by Ronald Binge, which always comes in ahead of the late ships, as my friend Ron Brown calls it. And he is an announcer on Radio 4. And the shipping forecast probably will be very familiar to your listeners on ABC, because someone like Jim Maxwell will pause, at least he used to, on long wave and say, and now we are leaving the cricket for the shipping forecast. And it's seen as this kind of quite, I suppose, nostalgic throwback. It was 100 years old last year, and it is a system of giving a forecast for the weather conditions in the seas around the UK. And it was put in place in the early 20th century to go out on the then new BBC radio to tell shipping what was to happen, what was to come. And it's been celebrated for a long time as this most beautiful found poetry. Many people find the shipping forecast very soothing and comforting.
You mean not just the music, the language of it, you mean, as well?
Yeah, the language of it. I mean, I have some here. Maybe I can read you a little bit of what the shipping forecast actually sounds
like. I would love you to, please.
Okay. This is BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Wednesday, the 1st of March. The general synopsis at 1800. High, Hebrides, 1043. Expected Faroes, 1039. By 1800 Wednesday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Cira, northerly, veering northeasterly, 5 or 6, occasionally 7 at first, becoming variable 3 or less later in southeast. Fair, good.
So this has become like compelling radio for people. Is it, in all honesty though, Dan, in an age of the internet, is it still needed?
Ah, that's a big question. I think, you know, what is necessary? If we only had necessary things, yes. I think our world would be very anemic.
It's nice to have, in other words.
It's nice to have. I don't know that there are many seafarers who still set their watch to be awake at 0048 of an evening to listen in religiously, because we now have, you know, we have satellite weather forecasts and things like that. But actually, the shipping forecast itself, it has a huge place in the national psyche of the UK and maybe around the world. People listen to it to feel comforted that it's being broadcast. They find it potentially soporific, and it's something that is something they listen to before they go to sleep or perhaps in bed. And I think it does have this found poetry to it. It is rhythmic. It is a voice. It is a voice broadcasting to those potentially in peril on the sea. And people have taken it to their hearts, generations of people. The idea of the BBC ceasing broadcast, I think, would be the equivalent of the Ravens leaving the Tower of London.
Well, maybe part of the appeal of it is, as you say, it's very comforting. And if you do it in the right tone of voice, you can have this feeling at that time of night, if you're hearing that being reported with that lovely music, that really someone's looking out for you out there. It's all right. The world's okay. You're safe. It's a safe feeling.
At one point, I was talking to people who work on nuclear submarines, the shadowy world of the submarines from the British Navy that carry a nuclear deterrent. And when they leave Britain and they dive for a period of months, they enter a state that is known as the Forever Night, which lasts maybe 3 or 4 months. And that submarine will be somewhere in the seas of the globe. And often what it will be doing is listening. One of the checks that they do to make sure all's okay with the UK is they listen in to Radio 4, BBC Radio 4. And if Radio 4 is off air, as this, you know, helpful but non-committal officer of the Royal Navy told me, then they would have a pretty good idea that something might have gone wrong in London. And that would be added to the list of things that maybe they need to do something about. So the fact that Radio 4 is cosy and it is nostalgic, there is that. But it also, ever since I was told that story, carries this kind of like vague sense of threat as well. So I think it's good for all of us that Radio 4 continue to broadcast it, because the alternative feels fairly apocalyptic.
It's unthinkable.
Yes.
Dan, it's been amazing speaking with you. Thank you so much for sharing these wonderful stories about the magic and mystery of the world at night. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you, Richard. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Dan Richards' book is called Overnight: Journeys, Conversations, and Stories After Dark. Today's conversation was made on the lands of the Gadigal people, produced by Alice Moldovan. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.